Anyway, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Before we get into it, I'd just like to ask for the Lord's blessing upon this. Father in heaven, I come before you in humility before your word and ask that your word alone would come forth. Not my word, Lord. Edit me out of it. Give us each one of us circumcised hearts and circumcised ears that we'd hear only what you're saying to us. I ask this, B'Shem Yeshua. Amen. Now, a certain individual in this church, I'm not going to name any names, asked me when they heard that I was going to be doing the message this week, "So, who are you going after this time? Which denomination are you going after this time?" And I went, "Ooh." Or something like that. I'm not sure I don't remember the exact question, but it was something like that. Now, whatever the exact wording was, I found this really disturbing. I mean, I hope I don't come across as somebody who attacks other Christian churches. That's dangerous. I certainly don't mean to. I will often speak against some pagan practices that have crept into the church over the years. But that certainly doesn't mean I reject the Christian church as a whole. That's ridiculous. Were it not for the Gentile church, I wouldn't be saved. I wouldn't be here. Many of us Jewish believers wouldn't be here were it not for the ministry of a Gentile to us. So I certainly don't attack the mainstream Gentile church as a whole. I just try to address some of the questionable things they sometimes do. And with this in mind, I ask you to turn to the Gospel of Luke, chapter 18. Anyway, Luke 18, chapter 9, verse 9. It's a very familiar parable to us. "Also, to some who were relying on their own righteousness and looking down on everyone else, he told this parable. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a parush, the other a tax collector. The parush stood and prayed to himself, 'O God, I thank thee that I am not like the rest of humanity, greedy, dishonest, immoral, or even like this tax collector over here. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes on my entire income. Blah, 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 blah.' But the tax collector, who was standing way back, would not even raise his eyes towards heaven, but beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me, sinner that I am. I tell you, this man went down to his home right with God rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but everyone who humbles himself will be exalted.'" Now, what I want you to note about this is, note the occasion of the parable. It was given to some who were relying on their own righteousness and looking down on everyone else. Note the comparison between trusting in one's own righteousness and focusing on others. See, the problem with the Pharisee here is that he compares himself to a human standard, not a divine one. I've no doubt, the Pharisee was more obedient to Torah than the tax collector. No doubt. I've no doubt that in a certain sense, he was certainly more righteous, for want of a better term, than the tax collector. But this still isn't righteous enough. It still falls short of God's righteousness, the righteousness that God expects. Yeshua himself said to those who would listen, "Unless your righteousness is far greater than the Torah teachers and Perushim, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." That's from Matthew 5, verse 20. The problem with the Pharisee is that he spends so much time looking down upon everybody else that he fails to examine his own standing with God, his own heart. But, you know, what's that to us? There aren't any Pharisees today, are there? Of course not. Oh, if only that were true. You see, we in the Messianic movement can say with great confidence, and we do, that the concrete spiritual descendants of the Pharisees are what is known as Rabbinic Judaism today. And true, the Rabbinic Judaism of today is directly traceable to the Pharisaic Judaism of the time of Messiah. However, immediately when we do that, when we label rabbinic Judaism as the dissents and the Pharisees, we're falling into the trap that the Pharisee fell into, aren't we? You see, we're looking down on others. We're thinking that we're better than them. If anyone thinks he is something when he is nothing, he deceives himself. That's from Galatians 6. So, at the risk of offending many people here today, and I guess that's why my time was really collapsed, but anyway, at the risk of offending many people here today, I suggest that the messianic movement itself can be considered an equally valid spiritual descendant of the Pharisees. And I certainly don't mean in a positive sense. Oh, you know, we sit around on Shabbat patting ourselves on the back, and we reckon ourselves so much better than the rest of Christianity. We look down on everyone else. I'm not saying this is true of everyone in the Messianic movement, don't get me wrong. But there is an underlying streak of pride of many within the movement. We've missed Shaul's warning. He says, about food sacrificed to idols, we know that, as you say, we all have knowledge. Yes, that is so. But knowledge puffs a person up with pride, whereas love builds up. The person who knows something doesn't yet know in the way he ought to know. Although this is ostensibly true, ostensibly about food, the warning is clear. Knowledge puffs a person up with pride. And this accords with another of Yeshua's criticisms of the Pharisaic mindset. He says, woe to you, Perishim, for you pay tithes of mint and rue and every garden herb, but you ignore justice and the love of God. You have an obligation to do these things, but without disregarding the others. Note that Yeshua doesn't condemn their practices of tithing. He doesn't. Rather, he condemns their ignorance of other, more important things. Likewise, it's obviously not wrong to practice in the Messianic movement things that they're practicing in the Bible. Obviously not wrong. Obviously not wrong. And to avoid those which we don't find there. But the trouble is, we have a tendency, and I include myself firmly in this, of concentrating on the minutiae, on the details. And we ignore the big picture. We claim we love God, but effectively we're condemning our closest neighbors on this planet, the Christian church. You see, over the years I've heard, in this Kehillah and in various other places, a great deal of pride expressed in that we worship on Shabbat, not Sunday. That we call our Savior Yeshua, not Jesus. And we have this same attitude over many, many of our practices versus the practices of the mainstream. But I ask everyone who has this attitude, what makes us so special? What do we have that we didn't receive as a gift? And if in fact it was a gift, why do we boast as if it wasn't? In other words, if the Lord has revealed to us that we are to walk in such and such a manner, whatever it might be, how dare we think that we're somehow special because the Lord has shown us to walk in this manner? How dare we think that? I mean, clearly, yes, there are practices in the mainstream church, in mainstream Protestantism, that are anti-scriptural. I've dealt with some of them in my devars in the past. And we don't follow these practices because God has shown us the truth. Okay? Note, it was God who showed us the truth. We didn't go looking for it. We didn't go knocking on God's door saying, can you show me the truth? Can you show me the truth? No, God revealed these things to us. See, truth is that which God reveals, not what we discover, what God reveals. And to believe that we ourselves have come to this position of knowing the truth is the height of arrogance. It's the same way as claiming responsibility for our own salvation. No, God revealed it to us. So, if the messianic movement is a Pharisee, who is the tax collector? Begs the question, doesn't it? I guess, if you follow my thought here, I guess it's the mainstream church. And, bear with me, not perfect, okay? Not perfect. But none of us are. Yet, the positive thing about the mainstream church is that usually to a man they'll say, by grace I have been saved. There but for the grace of God go I. They emphasize that it's only through what Yeshua, or as they call him, Jesus, did for them that they can stand before God. They're flawed. They readily admit it. We're sinners saved by grace. Seems to me that's an admission of a flaw. They at least acknowledge some of their flaws. So, I ask you, ask everyone here to answer this question for themselves. Who is more justified before God? A church where everything is done according to Torah, where everything, where they know every last detail of the Torah, but who regard themselves as somehow superior to those who don't do everything according to Torah. Or, on the other hand, a church that doesn't do everything according to Torah, but loves people, reaches out, evangelizes, all this stuff, and realize that the only standing they have before God is not in what they do, but what He did. I ask you, who is more justified before God? Seems to me fairly obvious. I'm not even going to bother answering it. And for that matter, even those of us who claim we walk according to the law, if at any point we judge others in the manner that I've described here, I present the following text. Anyone who claims to be in this light while hating his brother, and that's what effectively it is, it's hate, is still in the dark. The person who keeps loving his brother remains in the light, and there is nothing in him that could make him trip. But the person who hates his brother is in the dark. Yes, he is in the dark. He is walking in the dark, and he doesn't know where he's going, because the darkness has blinded his eyes. So, having established that the messianic movement's attitude towards mainstream Christianity, should we say, is at best problematic? But what can we say about the mainstream church's attitude towards us? Now, is it just us, or does it cut both ways? Shaul, when he writes to the Romans, addressed this issue in Romans 11, 16 through 20. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. But if some of the branches were broken off, and you, a wild olive, were grafted in among them, and have become equal sharers in the rich root of the olive tree, then don't boast as if you were better than the branches. However, if you do boast, remember that you are not supporting the root is supporting you. So you will say, branches were broken off, so I might be grafted in. True, but so what? They were broken off because of their lack of trust. However, you keep your place only because of your trust. So don't be arrogant. On the contrary, be terrified. For if God did not spare the natural branches, He certainly won't spare you. But, unfortunately, the church as a whole has ignored this warning. Look at history. Centuries of persecution by so-called Christians testify to a lousy attitude towards the Jewish people. And this persecution is largely promoted by a distorted anti-Semitic theological stance. And the basic theological problem is that of replacement theology. This is the problem they have with us, replacement theology. For anybody here who happens to be unfamiliar with the term, the basic concept is this. Well, there used to be a people of God called Israel. Now there's a people of God called the church. The one has replaced the other. It's pretty basic. And this theological abomination can be traced back to Saint Augustine. I use the term saint loosely. And his work, City of God. And since then, it has permeated both Catholic and Protestant theology. Replacement theology, in its most basic sense, takes all the promises that you find in the Tanakh and says, these apply to the church. It leaves the curses behind. And to be precise, it leaves the curses behind for the Jews. This theology is probably reflected in many of your Bible references and subject headings. Some Bibles have references to the church in the wilderness in Isaiah, or even in Deuteronomy. They also have references to the church in the Psalms, this, that, and the other, of the church. And whereas it would be really silly to deny that many of the principles found in the Tanakh, many of the principles dealing with Israel, can be applied to the church. Certainly they can. But it's a flaw to leap from this concept to their applying exclusively to the church. And that's generally what happens. Okay. Another subtle offshoot of replacement theology is the classic dispensationalist view of the rapture. Okay? The church will avoid the end times persecution, but the Jews will go through it. Well, that's nice. This teaching is not only anti-scriptural, it denies the reality that right now many believers throughout the world are suffering persecution to death. Go to the Sudan, go to China, go to Cuba. Who are we to think that we'll escape it? In North America. Still, I digress. The point is that although dispensationalism does throw a bone to Israel, it does. It says you still have a role. It's a ham bone. Look at the role that they give Israel. Persecution. Well, that's nice. Okay. Even more subtle is the concept that Gentile believers have become so-called spiritual Jews. I've even heard this said on occasion in the Kehillah. I haven't heard it from the Bema, though. But think about it. Is this not just a restatement of replacement theology? Think about it. What's wrong with being a spiritual Gentile? It was a spiritual Gentile that led me to the Lord. What's wrong with that? You see, spiritual Jews are those Jews who are believers. Spiritual Gentiles are those Gentiles who are believers. Jew and Gentile, equally spiritual, equally having the same access to God, but still as unique as male and female. You see, Shaul writes, there is no Jew or Greek. There is no male or female. But I'm sorry, when I got saved, it didn't mean I could go into the ladies' bathroom, did it? So there are some clear distinctives, okay? And so what does mainstream Christianity think about the Messianic movement? Well, depends who you ask. Some people call it a cult. Ooh. Of course, you do know what the definition of cult is. It's that church over there. Or, from wherever you are, it's the other church. It's the other guys. Okay. It's also accused of restoring the middle wall of partition. And anything else they'd like to think of it. You see, mainstream Christianity is comfortable where it's at, you see. And it doesn't like anything that challenges the status quo. And in a sense, the rebirth of the Messianic movement, because in truth it's way older than the Protestant church. But the rebirth of the Messianic movement has challenged things for them. Again, just as not all Messianics are arrogant, not all Messianics are full of pride, not all Messianics judge the church, not all Christians have this attitude towards the Jews, or towards Messianic Jews. Not at all. In fact, there are many today that are growing interested in the roots of the faith. However, there is a prevailing attitude, this attitude still prevails in the church as a whole, and also in messages given by various preachers on the radio and on TV. It's still prevalent. So, here we have it. It's the problem between two siblings, between the natural and the wild olive branches. The Messianic movement has an obsession with Torah, okay? It does. It's obsessed with it. And often it also has an equal obsession with Jewish issues in general, often blaming the church of today for all of the sins of the past. This is even reflected in the UMJC. The UMJC is an organizational body of Jewish believers. And their rule is that only Jews or spouses of Jews can become full members. Others become associates, but they can't become full members. I personally believe that if somebody is fully committed to Messianism or the Messianic movement, whether they are Jew or Gentile, they belong with me. They're my brother. I could care less what they were born as. And we should not place barriers on their entry. I'm offended by the UMJC's rule. But we should guard against the pagan traditions that have found their way into the church, certainly. And we should be really careful. But let's not blame all Gentiles for the sake of some things that were done, have been done. Of course, the mainstream church, on the other hand, has largely written off the Torah and replaced it with something it calls the law of Christ. And expects Jewish believers to become part of a great Gentile homogeny. We are expected to assimilate into the church and lose our Jewishness. This is equally wrong. Furthermore, this supposition that God's standard of righteousness has effectively been lowered is equally wrong. What was Yeshua's attitude to the Torah? If you turn with me to Matthew chapter 5, I'll begin at verse 17 and we'll just read it. It's pretty obvious what Yeshua thinks of the Torah. "Don't think that I have come to abolish the Torah or the prophets. I have not come to abolish but complete." Or most translations say fulfill. And then they go and interpret fulfill to mean end. "I did not come to abolish, I came to end." What would be the difference? So either he did come to abolish or he didn't. So he didn't. "Yes, indeed, I tell you that until heaven and earth pass away, not so much as a yud or a stroke will pass from the Torah, not until everything that must happen has happened. So whoever disobeys the least of these mitzvot and teaches others to do so will be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever obeys them and so teaches will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness is far greater than that of the Torah teachers and the Parashim, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." And then he goes on. What does Yeshua do to Torah? This is what he does. "You have heard that our fathers were told, do not murder. That's the commandment. And that anyone who commits murder will be subject to judgment. But I tell you, anyone who nurses anger against his brother will be subject to judgment. And that whoever calls his brother, oh, you good for nothing, will be brought before the Sanhedrin. And whoever says fool incurs the penalty of burning in the fire of Gehinnom." Ooh. Seems to me he abolished it good there, didn't he? He abolished it so well, he made it tougher. So that's what he means by fulfilling, by completing. You see, it's patently obvious that Messiah raised the bar, he didn't lower it. But the bad attitude towards Torah is probably due to a misunderstanding of the Torah's purposes to begin with. You see, classic Protestant theology has this concept that, well, Old Testament, law; New Testament, grace; New Testament, grace; Old Testament, law. And never the twain shall meet. Which is why they have to put that divider in the middle between the two, you see. Just in case you find yourself lost one day. Now, the fact of the matter is, I just read those words of Yeshua from the New Covenant, the Covenant of Grace. And you know what? He made it tougher. You go back into the Tanakh, and what happens? People are saved, for want of a better term, by by grace and by sacrifices that point forward to Messiah's sacrifice. You see, the Torah never did save people. People in Old Testament times weren't saved by keeping the law. That's utter BS. They were not saved by keeping the law. They were saved by exactly the same thing people are saved today, by the sacrifice of Messiah. Nothing else. But because many in the church have this misunderstanding of Torah, that it saved people in Old Testament times, and that now we're saved by Messiah, they make this big distinction. They throw out the Torah. They throw out the baby with the bathwater. It's a classic problem. People have never, ever been saved by obedience to the law. Simplest example of this is, look at the Exodus. When were they given the law? When they were in Egypt? Did God come to them in Egypt, give them the law and say, obey this and I'll let you out? No. He gave it to them when they were out, not when they were in. But you see, you because of this, you get we Torah obsessives in the Messianic movement, and the Torah diminishives, or whatever you want to call that, in the Gentile church. And there's a great problem because of this. You see, Messianic Judaism, the Messianic movement, is in danger of becoming merely just this carbuncle on the side of mainstream Christianity. Just this bump on the side. It becomes, at best, just another ethnic church, like the Korean church, like the Chinese church that you'll see in Vancouver. Just to go along with all the others. At worst, it becomes some kind of cult, as far as they're concerned. The mainstream church, again, confuses this concept of law and grace. And so briefly, this, you know, Messianic movement becomes this ghetto, just to the side, off to the side of Christianity. And for a great many of us in the Messianic movement, this is a very comfortable place for us to be, isn't it? We can sit around on Shabbat and preach to each other over lunch and never have to do anything. See, we're quite comfortable here too. As comfortable as the mainstream church is to shove us into this place, we're very comfortable here. We've ghettoized the Messianic movement. So, what's the remedy? Where do we fit in? And what should be our attitude to the church at large? Clearly, there's fault on both sides. We are each focusing too much on each other and focusing on how different and how better we are than the other. We've all fallen into the error that the Pharisee in Luke 18 had, both we in the Messianic movement and the mainstream church. We miss the mark. We're trapped in a sinful attitude. Scripturally, the relationship between Jewish and Gentile believers is quite simple. It is referred to in a number of passages. You have the olive tree metaphor in Romans 9 through 11. And the other is found in Ephesians chapter 2. And if you'd like to turn there to Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 through to 21. Therefore, remember your former state, you Gentiles by birth, called the uncircumcised, by those who merely because of an operation on their flesh are called the circumcised. At that time, had no Messiah. You were estranged from the national life of Israel. You were foreigners to the covenants and body and God's promise. You were in this world without hope and without God. But now you who were once far off have been brought near through the shedding of Messiah's blood. For he himself is our shalom. He has made us both one and has broken down the mechitza which divided us by destroying in his own body the enmity occasioned by the Torah with its commands set forth in the form of ordinances. He did this in order to create in union with himself from the two groups a single new humanity and thus make shalom, and in order to reconcile to God both in a single body by being executed on a stake as a criminal and thus killing in himself that enmity. Also, when he came, he announced his good news, shalom to you far off and shalom to us, to those nearby. News that through him we both have access in one spirit to the Father. So then, you are no longer foreigners and strangers. On the contrary, you are fellow citizens with God's people and members of God's family, You have built on the foundation of the emissaries and the prophets, with the cornerstone being Yeshua, the Messiah himself. In union with him, the whole building is held together. It is growing into a holy temple in union with the Lord. Yes, in union with him, you yourselves are being built together into the spiritual dwelling place of God. Now, this passage addresses the lousy attitude that both we, the natural, and the grafted in olive branches have. To the grafted in, we have a similar concept to that you find in Romans 11. He refers to their former state. You were estranged from the national life of Israel. You were foreigners to the covenants, without hope, without God, doomed, going to hell in a handbasket, basically, he says. But now what has happened? They are no longer foreigners and strangers. Rather, they are fellow citizens with God's people and members of God's family. And all this was accomplished through the shedding of Messiah's blood. So, again, what happened when Messiah's blood was shed? The people who were strangers to the promises, foreigners to the covenants, that is, the Gentiles, were brought near. Note what the death of Messiah did not do. It did not take Israel to where the Gentiles were. It doesn't do that. So this whole idea that today Jewish believers have to leave their Jewishness behind and assimilate into a largely Gentile church, that's ridiculous. The whole concept of Messiah was first given to them. Why would they go elsewhere? Rather, and this is the part addressed to us, okay? We as Jews must welcome them. Get that? Welcome them. Welcome them into the national life of Israel. Those who were strangers and foreigners are no longer strangers and foreigners. Or put it another way, if you go back to the olive tree, we natural branches should not resent the grafted in branches. You see, if we can grasp this truth, we can avoid the ghettoization of the messianic movement. We can avoid it if we grasp this. We must all cease to be Pharisees. And instead, we must adopt the attitude of the tax collector. Lord, you saved me. Thanks. That's basically his attitude. I didn't do it. You did. We must cease comparing ourselves to others and rather recognize our total dependence on Messiah's work. And just in closing, and I'll try to get off quick so you can get your lunch. I turn to one more parable. And again, it's found in the Gospel according to Luke. And it's Luke chapter 15, verses 11 to 32. I'll try and read it as quickly as I can. And Yeshua said, a man had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the estate that will be mine. So the father divided the property between them. And as soon as he could convert his share into cash, the younger son left home and went off to a distant country where he squandered his money in reckless living. But after he had spent it all, a severe famine arose throughout that country and he began to feel the pinch. And you know the story. He's feeding pigs in this other country and he goes, I've got to go home. And so he does. Now while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was moved with pity. This is verse 20. He ran and threw his arms around him and kissed him warmly. His son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But his father said to his slaves, Quick, put out a robe. Bring out a robe, the best one. Put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet. And bring the calf that has been fattened up and kill it. Let's eat and have a celebration. For this son of mine was dead, but now he's alive again. He was lost, but now he has been found. And they began celebrating. Now his older son was in the field, and he came close to the house. And as he came close to the house, he heard music and dancing, and he called one of the servants and asked, What's going on? The servant told him, Your brother has come back, and your father has slaughtered the calf that was fattened up, because he has gotten him back safe and sound. But the older son became angry and refused to go inside. So his father came out and pleaded with him. Look, the son answered, I have worked for you all these years. I have never disobeyed your orders. But you have never even given me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. Yet this son of yours comes, who has squandered his property with prostitutes, and for him you slaughter the fattened calf. Son, you are always with me, said the father, and everything I have is yours. We had to celebrate and rejoice, because this brother of yours was dead, but has come back to life. He was lost, but has been found. I'm sure this is probably the most familiar parable in the entire Bible for most of us. What I ask you to do here, though, is consider the characters of the younger and elder sons. The older son has always stayed at home and always been obedient to the father. The younger son went astray, but came back. And the elder son resents the father's affection for the younger brother. Again, we could compare even this to the relationship between the mainstream church and us in the messianic movement. See, because technically, we are an elder brother. The messianic movement has been away for a while, but we are the elder brother, not the younger brother. But we seem to have this problem. We don't like the fact that, well, how can God let them in straight away? You know, we kept the law for centuries, and now God's let the others in. Ooh. Got bad news for you. Oh, bad news for me too. He's God. He gets to let in who he wants. And perhaps, if the Gentile church sees that we do emphasize what Messiah did and not what we currently do. And this is the important thing. Emphasize what Messiah did, not what we're doing. Then maybe, just maybe on some of these other issues, they might listen to an elder brother's advice. But they certainly won't listen to us if we're sitting in a corner pointing fingers at them. Father in heaven, I thank you that you loved us so much that you sent Messiah to do what we could not do. That you have imputed to us the righteousness that is greater than the Pharisees and the righteousness that is greater than the Torah teachers. We thank you for that. Father, help us to just remember what the main thing is. The main thing is you died for us. And we must not forget that. As this B'Shem Yeshua. Amen.